Welcome back to Inside Track, to hour two of Inside Track. Today, Bruce Ash is here, along with Arizona Daily Star columnist and frequent participant here, just usually in the corner, sort of, listening to what's going on. David Layton, you know his work from reading the newspaper, and he's with us here. He just walked into the production room with Tom, giving him some information. We're broadcasting from the Perfection Auto Works studio, sponsored by Wilkinson Wealth Management, Essential Pest Control, Tucson Iron and Metal Retail, and Perfection Auto Works, where Mike makes autos great again. Our guest for the next several minutes is Dr. Donald Critchlow, PhD, who is the Katzen Family Professor, sorry about knocking into the microphone, at ASU, teaching courses on American political history, political conspiracy, and contemporary American history. He was awarded the Zebulon Pierce Distinguished Teaching Award in Humanities in 2021. He serves as the director of the undergraduate certificate program in political history and leadership in the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies at ASU. Now, we don't usually talk about ASU here because they are sports rivals of ours, but this is a great area at ASU. And Donald Critchlow is a fabulous researcher and a fabulous professor. I've had the honor of being in his classroom, and I've just had a great experience with the Institute, and I highly recommend him and the Institute. I support the Institute. We last talked with Donald about his book, Revolutionary Monsters, Five Men Who Turned Liberation into Monsters, a short while ago. I'm very pleased we've been able to snag him again. Dr. Critchlow and his colleagues just released their study of American history in our universities, and it's quite revealing. Donald, are you there with us?
Yes, I am, man. Good to hear you, Bruce.
Nice to hear you. Let me read the opening statement in Dr. Critchlow's introduction. I got to bring this a little closer up to my eyes. Nobody can deny there is a crisis in civic education in our nation today. This report spotlights the stark and worrisome contrast between the topics most civically involved Americans would expect in an introductory survey course on American history and what many professors have decided to teach instead. Indeed, this report's detailed analysis reveals the extent of the problem. Compiled data displays how higher education perpetuates this problem through ignorance. That is quite a statement, Professor. You speak the truth here, I think. What has been the reaction from your colleagues at ASU, and to the extent of what has been said off the ASU campus at other colleges and universities about the study?
Well, this report from the Center of American Institutions, which I direct, was released just last week. So Fox Business Digital News picked it up, and a number of other sites are beginning to pick it up. Epic Times ran an article. I was interviewed by the Wall Street Journal last week, so we're expecting further news. So what's important about this study is not what the reaction is going to be from any colleagues at ASU or U of A. This was a year-long study that we undertook at the Center for American Institutions, and we looked at syllabi of introductory courses, both halves of U.S. survey. And across the country, large universities, small universities, private and public, what we found was overwhelming emphasis on presentism, basically teaching identity theory and talking about, most courses, especially the second half, talk about the decline of America. So it wasn't just the what was being said, it was what was not being said. So we did a quantitative analysis of what topics that were left out, and hold to and you and your listeners hold fast here to your because you're about ready to explode. Even basic topics such as the Civil War, World War I, World War II, the Cold War, 9/11 were not discussed as seen in the syllabi. So if they talked about, and they also excluded major themes that were often taught, such as religion. So religion is totally left out of what's being taught. So that means you can't understand the abolitionist movement,
right,
or the women's suffrage movement, or Martin Luther King. We were surprised by how little Martin Luther King was even discussed. Instead we got some professors talking about ableism, and the students had to work on, ableism. And
what's ableism, doctor?
Ableism is a term such as homophobia, transphobia, that means that you don't respect people with disabilities.
Right.
I mean, so it's pretty obscure. You in a 15-week class, you're covering, you should be covering some just basic topics. And we're not insisting that these topics be interpreted in a right-wing way or a conservative way. We just are calling for them to be taught.
Hey, can't ignore history, can you?
Well, they're doing a good job of it. So even things like the New Deal, the Great Society, are left out. But what we also found, and this was surprising, is most of the courses, really, especially in the second half, talk about the decline of America. So professors might date the decline with the rise of the religious right, or with the Gingrich election in 1994, or
George W. Bush.
So this commission we did the year-long research, exhaustive research, and the commission was headed by Governor Scott Walker, Newt Gingrich, and former governor and representative from Oklahoma. So we expect this to have a major impact, primarily because we call for a number of reforms that could be undertaken by universities right now, and then we propose a long-term vision for really reimagining the universities.
And I think that's really the importance of, or part of the major focus of your study, is that you don't just talk about the problem, you're also making recommendations how to improve what degree seekers are trying to get from a college education, right?
Yes, we have Scott Walker is visiting Arizona in February. We're having a legislative briefing over some of our recommendations. We're obviously not lobbying the legislature because we're civil servants. But one of the proposals, so you can, listeners can understand, is what we call Educational Transparency Act, in which every academic unit at public universities put up links on their first web pages, on the first page of their websites, that lists the syllabi, lists the course enrollment, and then also every academic unit, because they're public institutions, should put up faculty minutes where they don't involve personnel, as well as administrative announcements. We think if there's greater transparency, that's the first step in reforming the university. And that's something that the legislature could push. So we're not talking about cameras in the classroom. We're not insisting, we're not undermining academic freedom, but where public universities across the country should put up their syllabi. It took us a year of arduous research, painstaking research, to even find 75 syllabi. And we quantified that. But I mean, is it that shocking that a public university students can't even find the syllabi from what professors are going to teach? And we should insist as a public that that there be transparency and openness. It's a public institution. Agencies have to put up their minutes. So why don't faculty units?
And that's a major. That's a major suggestion that you're making, is that there be greater transparency in what is being taught in these courses. Correct.
That's the first step, and also we also say that governing boards, regents, and should put pressure or ask presidents and deans to begin to conduct searches that are not narrowly defined as identity searches. So you don't need to have a Civil War historian who's looking just at race or any other identity topic. Why not have Civil War historians? What's left out of the syllabi is any diplomatic history, right, any political history, any business history, or any course such as history of money. So we're developing. And so So people are wondering what's going on in college campuses. Why so many students are supporting Hamas, demonstrating for Hamas, a barbaric death cult. And I think this goes to explain a lot of what's happening. So we're focused on the universities and colleges. We also need to begin to look at K-12 too, but that wasn't our focus.
I'm glad you brought up Hamas. Last week, as you may know, there was a pro-Hamas demonstration on the U of A campus whose signs flashing "Free Gaza," thus implying was in control of Gaza and not Hamas. How does this altered state of history exist? Gaza has been free since 2005. They elected Fatah. Fatah was overtaken by Hamas. And the only freedom that the citizens of Gaza really deserve is being free from Hamas. But this is not what is passing for education, I guess, in colleges and universities, or I'll be specific to the University of Arizona. Half of the protesters that day were professors who were teaching this stuff.
Yeah, well, we've had demonstrations in Arizona State. There are demonstrations all across the country. And let's be honest, some of those demonstrators actually do support Hamas, which is a death cult. It's not a liberation movement.
Right.
That's what it is. But I also think large numbers of those demonstrators are just kind of knee-jerk social justice warriors. So all you do is have to talk about liberation and they'll come out. So what we see is, you know, Bin Laden on TikTok, his letter to America, if anyone looks at that letter, which is basically incoherent, he spends a good deal of time attacking homosexuality, and that's somehow a sign of our weakness. So what we have are last year we had people who were feminist, trans defenders, and gay rights, and suddenly now they're on. Now they find themselves aboard the death ship of Hamas, which calls for the execution of gays and, of course, transgender people. They throw them off the roofs in Iran. So, I mean, and feminists that are going along and supporting this, any feminist teacher who's supporting Hamas that gang raped Israeli women and reports has scalped them are fools and hypocrites. But that, I think, is a reflection of what's been happening in our schools. We've created a generation of many students who hate America, who think that we're the West is an evil force in the world, and they're ending up supporting Hamas in the so-called call for liberation.
Donald, talk about why civic education is so essential to life in a constitutional republic such as ours.
It's basic, Bruce. You need to have, in a democracy, in a constitutional republic, You need to have an informed citizenry. That's what the founders in this great experiment in America in democracy understood. That it's just not the system of the government they were setting up or their structure. You needed to have a healthy culture and a informed citizenry. And if you don't understand the Constitution, if you don't know whether the Supreme Court justice is elected or my dog's barking.
That's a fierce doggy you have there, Donald.
Yeah, I'm going to take it. I'm going to go inside here. It will be dropped. But if you don't have an informed citizenry, you have an unhealthy culture that ultimately is going to mean the demise of that of your republic. And that's what we're facing right now, existential crisis. And I don't think I'm being hyperbolic or hysterical. We're seeing the consequences of a basically ideological program that's programmed our students, many of our students, to hate the country that they live in.
Donald, David Layton from the Arizona Daily Star, a columnist with them, is with me today. David, a quick question for Dr. Critchlow.
Doctor, just a quick question. How many universities were included in this study?
We found 73 universities and 75 syllabi, and that's all we could find. We began our search looking at history department websites and individual faculty profiles, and then we finally were able to find public access sources that students had posted across the country listing their syllabi.
I gotcha. Did it also include any community colleges, or was it strictly the university level?
Yes, good question. We started off looking at the top 150 universities. In the second half, we expanded it to the top 200 universities, but we didn't look at community colleges.
Okay, and I would assume some Ivy League colleges were included, like Princeton and Harvard as well.
Yes, and we included those universities as well as large public universities. We didn't look at any Arizona school, just to make sure that there wasn't any bias. One of our senior researchers is a visiting scholar from Ohio State University, where she's a professor, and we didn't include Ohio State University. But to make sure that we weren't cherry-picking when we picked out, when we talked about the syllabi, we did an exhaustive quantitative analysis. And this report could be found at Center for American Institutions, CIA, at ASU-EDU.
Okay. And just off the top of your head, do you know how many of the Ivy League schools are included in this study?
A number. I don't have it off the top of my head. But I want to emphasize this. I don't think this is an Ivy League problem. I think it's a problem across the board. I think it's both private and public universities. And we found a uniformity. So the idea that this is just coming from the Ivy Leagues or Ivy Leagues are the worst is not the case. I mean, this is uniform across the university system.
I got you. Yeah, my thought was maybe it might be, you know, considerably worse among the Ivy League schools if that was a preponderance of that, but it sounds like it's pretty widespread,
cross section. Yeah,
we didn't in our report. We don't name faculty, and we didn't name the schools either. But we found regional school public universities actually in the Midwest, as well as states such as Texas, even sometimes worse than what was being taught at some of the Ivy League schools. I mean, So, yeah, I mean, this idea that Ivy League is the problem, I think
it's endemic.
Arizona and other schools, yeah, I mean, it is across the board. It's pretty endemic.
So, Donald, we just have a couple minutes left, and unfortunately, we had a caller, but I want to get this question in because I think it talks to the severity of the problem. Talk about the focus by college institutions today teaching inequality, conquest and imperialism, gender and toxic masculinity, violence as endemic in American history. These things you report are going on as major themes that play out, you know, in teaching in history courses. But some of this actually starts in grade schools and high school, doesn't it? So by the time kids get to college, they've actually had several years of this sort of conditioning that, you know, this is a crappy place to live and it's a miserable society we exist in, don't they?
Absolutely. That's what's going on. They're being basically, I would say, programmed in, throughout their K through 12 in various ways in various subjects. And then when they get to universities, it's basically kind of reinforcing and trying to add sophistication to their anti-American social justice outlooks. Nobody is opposed to social justice. We're not opposed to teaching about identity in the classes. We're arguing that there needs to be greater inclusion of just basic facts that are necessary for informed citizenry, and they can. And it's up to the professors; they can interpret it any way they want. But they have a basic obligation if you're teaching Introduction to American History to inform students of basic things that have gone on in America, such as the American Civil War. So we have some. Just very briefly, we have. I think we found. That conquest and violence took up about, in some courses, a 15-week course took up 3 weeks. So they're spending a lot of time talking about how we were violent. The white Europeans were violent to begin with, and that became endemic throughout the history. So so anyway, that's where we are. We're going to have to begin to do something as citizens in our state and across the country.
Dr. Donald Critchlow, we're at the end of our time here today, but this is the first in what I hope will be a continuum of conversations that we have on the topic. Thanks for joining us today. More importantly, thanks for everything that the Institute is doing at ASU. I wish we had something that was going on with the quality and level of speakers and so on that you do. Tell our listeners how to find out more about your study on American history and the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies.
That's where I'm a faculty member. That's the history department. They want to go to the ASU site and then look at Center for American Institutions, which is separate from that school. So it's Center for American Institutions, it's CAI at ASU.edu. And the report is up. They should take a look at it. It's a 75-page report. It's exhaustive.
Donald Critchlow, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bruce. Look forward to talking soon. Bye-bye.
You bet. When we return after a quick break for some ads from our great supporters, Arizona State Representative Gail Griffin joins us to talk about water law in Arizona. Don't push that button. We'll be right back.
Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up with science.
You mean you don't use a shoe?
No, we use the latest in technology and innovation to eliminate bugs, termites, weeds, and more.
No spray cans and lighters?
None of that. Only solutions that target insect biology, using chemistry to help protect the environment, people, and their pets.
Huh. Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up. Call 886-3029 or visit EssentialPest.com.
We take you to winter 1776.
Message for General Washington.
Yes, Captain.
Oh, hello, sir. Colonel Lee says the Redcoats are encamped just across the river at Trenton, sir.
We need to get the boats down to the Delaware, but the wagons are too noisy. What to do?
Begging the General's pardon, sir, Eustace Emery III, and I can lube those wagon axles so they don't squeak, sir.
Do it, Sergeant Emery.
And so, Washington's army crossed the Delaware.
We can grease your modern car truck axles, change the oil, charge the air conditioning, and do brakes, belts, and hoses on all brands, foreign and domestic. If you want a mechanic that cares about your car and your Thanksgiving, call 323-8650. That's 323-8650 and perfectionautoworks.com.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. Some people view market declines as a time to panic. Good news, that's wrong. Markets have never gone down and then failed to come back to create new highs, and this time it's not different. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call Eb Wilkinson at 777-1911. That's
777-1911. It's on. Welcome back to Inside Track. Bruce Ash back at you. I'm here with David Layton from the Arizona Daily Star. Thanks for coming in today and sitting in with me, David.
I appreciate you having me in.
Eb is up in Phoenix doing God's work with the National Rifle Association, so glad to have you here in the studio with us. I want to remind all of you to support our great Inside Track sponsors, Eb Wilkinson at Wilkinson Wealth Management, Eric Rudin, Essential Pest, Jamie and Craig at Tucson Iron and Metal Retail, and Mike Emery from Perfection Auto Works. We support each of these locally owned and family-run businesses. So should you. Our final guest today is veteran. I shouldn't say you're a veteran. I should say that you're a great legislator, and leave it at that. You've been around government for a while, but that I don't want you to think that I'm picking on you for being around for too long. I hope you stay there for as long as you want. Our final guest today is state representative from District 19 in Southeast Arizona, Gail Griffin. Gail and I, as you could tell by my joshing with her here, we're good friends and have been for a long time. But that is not why she joins us today. We all know that in Arizona, whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting. And there has been a big fight in the legislature over water, not just with the Democrats, but within the Republican Party as well. Water has been critical to Arizona's growth and prosperity, and the decisions being made today could have a profound effect on our future growth and prosperity. Welcome to Inside Track, Gail.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I can't remember. Were you on with us before, maybe when Emil Franzi was the principal host? I seem to have a recollection of it, but maybe I'm not remembering right.
I believe I was once before.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, you do.
But it's been a while.
If you go on to Gail's page, her legislative page, and look at the number of pieces of legislation that she's involved in, Gail is one of the 10% at the Arizona State Legislature who do 90% of the work. So let's start by finding out if there is a water crisis in Arizona today, or if there's one likely to occur in the future. Your opinion on whether we have a water crisis today or if one is likely in the future.
Well, Bruce, as you know, I chair the House Natural Resource, Energy, and Water Committee, so we see all the water bills that come across our committees in the House. We are not out of water. And there's a lot of tools in the toolbox that we can implement to make sure that we stay that way. We are not out of water. And as you know, we only have 13% of land in Arizona right. That is in private hands. That's our tax base. And so the agenda, these bills that have been proposed the last 4 years, have been proposed and worked on by the Environmental Defense Fund and several other radical environmental groups. They're headquartered out in New York. They're trying to implement California water grabs, and we have been standing in their way from that, allowing that to happen. Since we did not hear the water bills, which is 1306 and 2731, one in the House, one in the Senate, The governor has taken it upon herself. The Environmental Defense Fund, I understand, has knocked on her door and said, hey, you need to do something about this. And so she has taken it upon herself to create a water council, groundwater council, and two subcommittees are Assured Water, which is the city's water active management areas, and Rural Water Committee. And I requested, since I live in rural Arizona, their rural committee, subcommittee. And, of course, I got the city subcommittee. And so part of everything that they're putting together is a lot of regulatory takings. They don't want lot splits to occur. I think we've finally convinced them that that's not going to happen. If they have to have legislation, it's just not going to happen at the Arizona legislature. And some of the other things that they want is they don't want to give you a building permit unless you can prove a 100-year supply. Those are some of the recommendations that have been coming out of this council. And so regardless of where you live, even if you're not in an active management area, they still want you to prove a 100-year supply before they want the city or county to give you a building permit. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
So I had always thought that in order to have growth in cities and towns, that there had to be that water assurance. Is that not the case?
It is for if you're in an active management area.
Okay, you do have, so that's the differential here.
That is. Now, the counties, back in 2007, the legislature gave the counties the ability, even though they were not an active management area, to pass a policy for adequate water supply. That's the same, almost the same thing. You still have to have a 100-year supply. The only counties that have adopted that are Cochise County and Yuma County. The other counties are smart enough not to do it, but we in Cochise County and Yuma County did. And of course, Yuma County has all the water in the world. They're close to the water. Cochise County is not. And so in 2011, when I went to the Senate, all three of the supervisors in Cochise County came to me and said, oops, we made a mistake. Can you help me? And let's review it. And if we don't have problems, then let's let it repeal and go away, sunset. I tried for 3 years to do that, even got it on Governor Ducey's desk, and he vetoed it. And what happens is if it passes at the county level, it overlays the cities. So whatever the county adopts, the Sierra Vista and Fort Huachuca is doing wonderful things on water conservation, but they're subject to it as well. And so was Benson and Bisbee and Douglas, and Douglas already had an adequate water supply. They had a certificate proven 100-year supply. The Environmental Defense Fund and other environmental groups went door to door, I'm told, to get signatures and vote on an active management area, which it did pass. So what that did for Douglas, it wiped out that 100-year supply they had already, certificate for adequate water supply. Now they have to start all over in an active management area and prove the 100-year supply. So it's just another way to stand in the way of growth. And nobody is mentioning economies. And, of course, they're targeting agriculture, which I represent the natural resources state, and agriculture is a $23 billion industry for Arizona. And, you know, we all like to eat. Some of us too much. But
everything should be grown or raised elsewhere, right?
Yeah, right. And so there is a plan. Those that don't want to continue in agriculture, there's a plan to work and see how they can turn their lands, because most of the farmers that have kids that have gone to college and want to become doctors and lawyers and other engineers and what have you, and no longer want to be farmers, when they decide it's time to sell, then they should be able, that's the inventory for our subdivisions, for our builders and developers.
So, Representative Griffin, is this a battle between conflicting ideologies on the environment, where, you know, these different alliances, liberal, leftist agendas, are trying to basically change our way of life here in Arizona? Or is this between cities and rural areas?
It's both. It's both. In fact, the environmental, if you go to the internet and you look up the objectives for the Environmental Defense Fund, let me read it to you. It says groundwater management plans include water trading. Water trading in California and Arizona is on track to double from 2016 to 2025. It's a water grab. They'll tie up the water and then they'll sell it to the highest bidder. And the little guy's going to get...
So is this California trying to steal Arizona's water?
It's all of the above. It's all of the above. Whoever has... And keep this in mind. Whoever controls the water controls the economy, controls it all. And so the tribes already own 46% of the Colorado River water. The three major counties that have the Colorado River water, of course, is Pinal, Pima, and Maricopa County. The rest of us are on groundwater and as rural areas in those counties as well. And so the four items that will allow one of these water councils or committees to be formed, and the governor makes the appointments. So that tells you one thing. I never thought we'd have a Democrat governor in the ninth floor, but we do.
Right.
But she would make the appointments. And the individuals would, if you're using groundwater for drinking water, it qualifies for one of these water committees. If they tie surface water and groundwater together, and that is something that we have fought for decades, because some that want your water, they will, you know, some are entitled to surface water. If they tie surface water and groundwater together, it's one thing they'll go after. They'll go after all of it. And then if groundwater exceeds recharge, and we've got some great recharge projects and tools in the toolbox that we can increase water, putting water into the ground. And if there's an indication of overpumping, well, who makes that determination? So there's
a bunch of unelected officials,
unelected bureaucrats. Yeah. Absolutely.
Let me read from a letter you sent to Governor Hobbs. This was sent by yourself and many other important water users here in Arizona. The so-called local groundwater stewardship area, LGSA, proposal being rammed through an unfair process is vehemently opposed by the undersigned organizations and individuals. The LGSA proposal is neither local nor fair, and to be clear, not supported by rural Arizona's agricultural producers. What we have witnessed so far in the Rural Groundwater Committee is nothing more than an exercise to justify a proposal that has already been roundly rejected by the Arizona legislature several times, despite the opposing voices representing rural water users and agricultural interests. So there was a crack up this past session, not just between Republicans and Democrats, but really within the Republican Party caucus as well. What's going on, and how do we all get back on the same page? Is that possible?
It is possible. You know, just by finding out the facts and disclosing the facts. In fact, the people that have signed on that letter was Western Growers. That's Yuma. That's Greens, that's your salads, the Maricopa County Farm Bureau, Arizona Farm and Ranch, Arizona Farm Bureau, Arizona Cotton Growers, and Arizona Cattle Feeders. So this is the economy in rural Arizona from these people. Not only did they sign a letter, but also there were 12 supervisors that signed a similar letter, right, in opposition to this, and all of Graham County supervisors, to include the Democrat that's on the supervisors, and two of the three in Cochise County and Navajo, Yuma County, Mojave County, Gila County, and Greenlee County, and others have signed in opposition. They want to be at the table. And some of the proposals that were made by the Arizona Farm Bureau were just tossed aside, not even considered. The same thing that Senator Kerr that represented on the rural subcommittee, she presented a good workable water pause if certain things occurred. And that what it would do is just not allow growth, continued growth, expansion of growth for 5 years until the study on the water basin was looked at. So if there was a water basin in peril, then one of these could, you have to have a vote, you'd get signatures just like you do on a proposal, and that wasn't even given a consideration. So everything that those two people presented weren't even considered.
So,
on top of that,
yeah, Bruce, go ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead.
$50 million a year out of the lottery funds are proposed in these two bills to go towards conservation, and conservation is not defined. It could be conservation easements, taking property out of,
right,
anything. It's not defined. It could be freezing of land use. And it could go towards cities, counties.
So it's not just an issue that affects farmers and ranchers. It's also something that could potentially affect development, accommodating for future population growth, not even including exterior. But, you know, people here are reproducing and having children, and they're not all moving away because it's a pretty good place to live. This would affect the real estate business, increase the cost of homes because there's, scarcer amount of land that's available for development as well. This thing has many tentacles. So you've been criticized by officials, I understand, in Mojave County on the issue. What differences might exist in groundwater use between counties in Southeast Arizona and Northwest Arizona, such as in Mojave County, where some of this criticism is coming from?
Well, the original representative from Mojave County that sponsored the first bill is no longer at the Capitol, but she flat out told me that they wanted the water that the agriculture community was using for their industrial development. I said, are you meaning you want to put the agriculture out of business? And she says, they're using our water that we need for our industrial development. So if we allow these water councils to have their say, now keep in mind, the plan is not written and the goals are not written.
Right.
It's a blank check to fill in the blanks later after it passes. And so there are a number of us that are meeting and going around the state. We'll be in Yuma next month and talking to the communities as to what they want to see in water management. And again, we passed $1.4 billion with a B to the Water Infrastructure Finance Authority in several different buckets to be used for water conservation, to either bring it in from other places to do projects for Mountain Front Recharge or other recharge projects, keeping in mind that 95 to 98% of the rains we get evaporates before it gets into the ground. Why aren't we saving another 5 or 10% and putting it into the ground?
Right.
That would take care of it right there. So we have tools in the toolbox, forest management. We can create new wet water for proper forest management instead of seeing them burn. SRP and CAP are working on an interconnect so that waters could flow both ways. And, of course, that would help Pima County. And Tucson Water, I have to brag about Tucson Water. They, when they started, their water depths were at 400 feet. Because of what they're doing for recharge, their water depths are at 200 feet. So it's working. So if it's working there, why can't it work in the whole state? It can. We just need to put the radicals aside and confuse the issue with actual facts.
Yeah, we have a caller, Mark, who has a question for you. Mark, this is Representative Gail Griffin. Go ahead with your question, please.
Yes, I dearly treasure and adore Gail Griffin for what you've done also. But anyway, I live out in the desert, out by Vail area, and we are 10 homes on a well, and I someday want to put in my own well. What kind of, will I be able to do that, put in my own well?
Well, if this legislation is passed through the governor's council and it passes the legislature, I can tell you, as chairman of the House Natural Resource, Energy, and Water Committee, I won't hear a bad bill. So I'm going to stand firm, and you'll probably hear some more arrows going my way, but it's okay because I'm a big girl. Part of that is if one of these councils are formed, they can dictate whether you can drill another well. They want to put meters on wells. And again, some of the areas, Mark, are being targeted and have been sued for their water. And so if you put a meter on your well, that's public information. Anybody can submit to the Department of Water Resources Freedom of Information Act and find out how much water you have, and they can sue you for it. Southwest Center for Biological Diversity is very good at that. And so right now, depending, you still have to get permission from the Department of Water Resources, but you can do that now. But if one of these councils go in and in their goals and in their plan that they can say yes or no for individual wells, we're all in trouble because I live out in the middle of nowhere as well, and I have my own individual well. They don't see the unintended consequences when they're making rules and policy and laws. And we're here to protect the people. That the purpose of government, the Arizona Constitution says, is to protect and defend individual rights, and that's what we're trying to do.
Thanks for your call, Mark. Very good question. In the couple minutes that we have remaining, let me go from water, Gail, which kind of makes my head hurt. I mean, it is a super complex issue, and I remember talking to John Kyle years ago. He and Carl Hayden, probably the two most influential federal officials to have brought more water and greater water resources here in Arizona. If I'm a member of the legislature, why would I do anything which takes away power that the legislative body has given to them under the state constitution and give it to unelected bureaucrats and some who are very unfriendly to our very nature of living here in Arizona? Why would I, a Republican or a Democrat, and I understand that some Republicans are in favor of taking these rights away from the legislature, why would anybody vote to give up rights that you have as legislators under the Constitution?
I can't imagine why. I just can't imagine why. They don't understand why they're there, obviously. And maybe they don't understand. And I have sat down with, on a one-to-one, most of the House members and some of the Senate members as well. But once you lose your right to water, you will never, ever get it back.
Never.
This plan, it's temporary. And they've said that in the governor's council meetings. It's temporary. Let me tell you how it's temporary. Every 10 years, they get to review it. And if none of those four items that I read off are still in existence, it can be repealed. We will always use groundwater for drinking water. It will never go away. It's permanent.
It's unbelievable that we find ourselves in this situation, and some of the Republican members of the legislature, some even in the so-called Freedom Caucus, are not on the right side here. And I'm not trying to get you into a pissing contest with your colleagues. That's Bruce speaking. But it just doesn't make any sense from a political standpoint to give up any amount of power that you have. You were elected by the people to represent the people and to, as Gail very, very well put, said, the state constitution is there to protect the rights of people, and this takes rights away from people.
Absolutely does.
Well, thank you very much. This topic makes my brain hurt sometimes because it's very tough to understand. Where can our listeners go to find out more on water and what's going on this important topic?
They can call my office, and you know, it's you can get that through the internet or call the Capitol and ask for my office and leave a name and phone number where I can get back to you. And I've been going around other areas, and I'll be happy to meet with anybody, to include our members at the legislature, and trying to sit down and say, why do you want this, or why do you want that? Do you realize this will do this? And you know, my door is always open.
Gail, we got to go. We're at the end of the hour. Thank you very much. Tune in next week when we have another great show ready for you. On behalf of myself, co-host Eb Wilkinson, David Layton, who's here with me, producer Tom Fairbanks, and all of us at KVOI, best wishes for a family-rich and abundant Thanksgiving, celebrating the greatness of our nation. Until next Saturday, this is Bruce Ash and
David Layton
wishing you all a great weekend, a great Thanksgiving holiday. Please join us again in 166 hours. Go Cats!
Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
A lot of the cities and the counties around have initiatives for artists. I think we're one of the premier artist suppliers for steel. First Saturday of every month, you can come down early and actually go through the scrap yard across the street. It's 7 acres of metal. You can walk through with our people and pick out what you want. It's always interesting to see what the artists have done. We've done actually a couple projects with the U of A Engineering Department and Music Department, where the engineering music students came down together. They had to pick something out of the scrap, and they had to build an instrument. And we have one of those in front of the plant. Some really cool things come out of the scrap.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street, open Monday through Saturday.
It's fall 1621, and the pilgrims are readying their crops. But in the turkey barn, trouble is brewing.
We cannot stand for this injustice. All turkeys are equal. Just some of us are more equal than others. We shall not end up on a dinner table. We will escape.
Oh no, we must capture those turkeys.
I can fix that, Governor. I'm an auto mechanic.
Eustace Emery, mechanic? Strange no one's invented the automobile yet. Oh well, if you can capture the turkeys, do it.
And so Thanksgiving was saved because Eustace Emery invented the Plymouth Arrow and recaptured the turkeys.
Perfection Auto Works, 1046 North Beverly, 323-8650. Or perfectionautoworks.com, 323-8650.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. When people turn 50, something miraculous happens. They start to get serious about retirement planning. They've done very well so far and want to be certain they power into the retirement they've earned. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.